The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello, this is Michael Morpurgo for the Guardian Children's Books Podcast.
Oh, no, it isn't. Well, yes, it is, as well. Michael came in the other day to talk about the First World War to two London children, Orly and Fernando. We were so impressed at the level of discussion and the importance of relating this terrible heritage of conflict to the next generation that we thought everybody ought to hear it. So, back to you, Michael.
Hello, hope you're all right. We're going to be talking about writing about war, and I've made this collection called Only Remembered, which we're going to be talking about, amongst other things, and I thought I'd read a piece from it. What it is I've asked rather extraordinary people, interesting people, to write about, tell me about what it is that the First World War in particular meant to them. And you may know the wonderful illustrator and writer Raymond Briggs. If you don't, you should. Anyway, I asked him, because of the snowman, all the wonderful things that he's done. And he wrote this. Try to remember when you're listening to it that he's even older than me. I'm 70, and I think Raymond must be 80, around there. So he's been alive a long, long time. Auntie was the name used by children for any old lady in the 1930s and 40s. A child would seldom use the lady's full name, Miss Smith or Mrs. Bennett, for example, unless they were an authority figure such as a schoolteacher. Nor would a child dream of using the lady's first name, Ethel or Marjorie, but Auntie Ethel, and Auntie Marjorie was okay and more polite. It was odd, because these ladies were not our real aunties. But then some of them were. I was evacuated to a stone cottage in Dorset with Auntie Flo and Auntie Betty. Flo was my real aunt, Betty was not. As for these ladies being old, it was many years before I realised that they were only middle-aged. They belong to that unlucky generation born around 1900. So they would have been about 18 in 1918. Just the age to be on the lookout for a boyfriend and hoping to get married. To a child, anyone over 40 seems old. But when you are 80, as I am now, 40 is peanuts. Boys of my generation, born about 1935, were called up for national service in the Army or the Air Force aged 18. Some were sent out to fight in the Korean War, and many were killed there. Really, they were still schoolboys. Korean War? Ever heard of it? I was very lucky. I was given deferment from national service for 1 year to complete my 4-year art course. I became 18 in 1952, so finally went into the army in 1953, the very year the Korean War ended. Phew, just missed it. I was lucky with the year I was born. The aunties were very unlucky with theirs. And here's his poem that he wrote. Aunties. When I was a child, there were always lots of aunties. They were everywhere. Some were real aunties. Mum's umpteen sisters. Dad's umpteen sisters. There was no end of them. Auntie Flo, Auntie Betty, Auntie Edie, Auntie Marjorie, Auntie Bertha, Auntie Jessie, the list is endless. I won't go on except for Auntie Violet, my favourite auntie, killed on a bus in the Blitz. It seemed quite natural. It didn't give it a thought. That was the way the world was. Lots of old ladies everywhere. They were called spinsters. Some were rather quaint and looked down upon. A few were slightly mad. Then one day, when I was grown up, it dawned on me. First World War. 1 million men were missing. Why hadn't I thought of it before? The men these women never met, never even had the chance to meet. All dead. These ladies were always kind, gentle and loving to me, not sour, bitter and resentful, as they had every right to be. 1 million missing men, 1 million aunties. By Raymond Briggs.
Hello, I'm Orly and I'm with Fernando. We're both from London and we're going to be asking Michael Morpurgo some questions.
What message do you want to give to children by basing so many of your books on the war?
I don't want to give a message to children. What I want is to tell a story to children, and then I want the children to make of it what they would like to make of it. I'd like them to make up their own minds. But there's no doubt about it, I have a particular take on war, an understanding of war, feeling about war, and that comes through in my stories. But I don't write my stories to make you believe something. I suppose if I'm honest, because I have been a teacher, and I'm a parent, and I'm a grandfather, is that when you talk to children, or when you write a book, which you know children are going to read, what you would like is that it makes them think, because that's what books are all about. It's to make us think and to understand ourselves and the world about us better. So that's what I write for. I'm not in the message passing business. You'd need a pigeon for that.
How does writing about war help you cope with your feelings about it?
It is, I think, maybe one of the main reasons I do write about war. I was born in 1943, so I grew up after the Second World War, with the sights and sounds of what that war left behind, both in terms of broken buildings and broken families and broken society, and a lot of unhappiness. There was a lot of grief when I was growing up. A lot of people were missing. And my parents were very sad about that. And when you're young, as you know, Fernando, things matter. And I'm here to tell you, because you won't know this yet, that the things that matter to you when you're very little will matter to you all your life. You don't forget them. And sometimes they're quite disturbing and upsetting. And I think it's quite true that I do write a great deal about war because I'm still trying to work out why it is that we do it now, after all this time, after two world wars during the last century, why we still are making wars around the world. It upsets me profoundly because I know what happens because of my own family losing an uncle when one member of your family is killed in a war. And what happens is this. Yes, that person's not there. I never knew this uncle. It was my Uncle Peter, and he's just a photograph to me on a mantelpiece. I never met him. He died in 1941 in the RAF. He was killed. But what I did witness was the grief that went on all my mother's life. My mother was his sister, and all her life until she died, this was the big grief of her life. And grief doesn't die when people die. It lingers on and lingers on, and it can turn into other things. It can turn into anger. It can turn into vengeance. It's really the worst outcome of any war because, to my way of thinking, war doesn't solve things. It simply postpones solutions which are anyway going to be arrived at in the end by people talking. There's this wonderful old soldier called Harry Patch, who was the last soldier of the First World War to die, aged over 100 and something. And he said, and he'd lived through that whole First World War, and he knew it firsthand, had seen all the terrible things we hear about and know about, but he'd seen it himself, lived through it. And he said, right at the end of his life, that at the end of the day, people are going to get round a table and sort it out. So why do we have to go through this horror before they do?
Are the characters from War Horse based on real people and animals?
I suppose they're not based on people I knew. But the idea for the story came from people I knew and the place. I live in the middle of Devon. I live in this tiny little village. And it's there I set the beginning of the story. This is where the horse, the foal, Joey, grows up on the farm that I live on. That's where the horse grew up. So in my mind's eye, that was the place. When it comes to the people, what I did is I met, by chance, an old man, we're talking 40 years ago, who was 80 then himself. A man called Wilf Ellis. And I discovered he'd been to the First World War as a young man, and it was he who told me his story for hours and hours and hours. And then I discovered there was another old man in the village who'd been there with horses, and I talked to him. So I did talk to the people who'd actually been there, but I did not use their characters as such in the book. Those were invented characters, in so much as any character is invented, because when an author, a writer, a storyteller makes a character, what she or he is always doing in a way is taking something from one person they know and something from some characteristic from another person and weaving them together to create a new character. So in that sense, all the characters you create are some kind of amalgam of someone that you've known.
Why did you decide to write War Horse from an animal's point of view instead of a human's?
There have been many books written about war and the First World War from one side or the other. So in the First World War, for instance, there are many, many books written from the German side, from the French side, from the British side, many plays. And so I thought, well, if you're going to write about this war, why are you writing about it? I wanted somehow to create a story which showed the universal suffering of war, that is, the suffering on all sides. Now, 10 million soldiers died in that war, and we do not know how many million civilians. It was in the millions, that's for sure. So I thought, well, if you're going to write a story, try and tell it from a neutral point of view somehow. And the horse for me was the perfect way of doing it, because I could have a horse and I'd work this out, brought up in my farm in Devon before the First World War, sold off to the army, trained as a cavalry horse, British cavalry horse, listening all the time to British voices, hearing everything from the British point of view, then going across to France and seeing the French countryside, and being captured quite early on after a charge by Germans, who then used the horse for pulling guns or pulling ambulance. And then the horse saw the war from the German point of view. And then Joey winters on a French farm and sees it from the French civilian point of view. So I thought that might shine new lights on this war. That's what I was trying to do. So that's the reason I wrote it in a horse's voice. It was potentially a really silly thing to do, because, as you know perfectly well, Fernando, horses don't talk. And they certainly don't sit down and write books very often. However, one horse before me had done it, and that was Black Beauty. And the problem is it's almost the only really famous book written by a horse. But I took the risk. I don't know if it worked.
Did you always aim for your books to be read by children?
No, I don't aim for my books to be read by anyone. I'd like them to be read by lots of people, because that buys me socks, if you know what I mean. Because every book that you sell, you get a little bit of money and then you have another pair of socks, and I love socks. So in a way, I don't care who reads my books. I love it that children sometimes do. The reason they do is because I write about children a lot, and sometimes I write about animals, and children seem to have an affinity with animals. So I think there's a natural kind of connection between my books and children. But I do not sit down and write books for children your age or anyone else's age. I just tell the story and hope that children and grown-up children will read them too, because to me the best stories are the ones that we all read.
What is your favourite book from the ones you have written? Why?
I wish you wouldn't keep asking such good questions. It's making me think. I think what I love is when the people I love like a book. So and my wife, Claire, loves War Horse. She thinks it's the best book I've ever written. Well, it's not. But she loves it. Therefore, I love it. Do you understand what I'm saying? There are other books I love because everyone else hated them, which is bizarre. But a book, when you make it, is quite like a child. You feel very protective towards it. And so when you write a book and there's some review comes in a newspaper, have you ever heard of a newspaper called The Guardian? You've heard of this. It's an interesting thing, but many, many, many years ago, I wrote a book called Twist of Gold. And someone in this newspaper, terrible newspaper called The Guardian, wrote this review, which was horrible, about my book and said how dreadful it was and all this. You never forget the cruel things that people say. And so consequently, Twist of Gold is one of my favorite books. I put a wall of protection around it. The book you've just written is always the one that's still buzzing around your head and you think is your best. And I've just written a book which is called Listen to the Moon. And it's a story about a girl who survives the sinking of a great ship in 1915. There was a ship called the Lusitania, which was torpedoed. And many, many hundreds of people, over 1,000, were lost. And this little girl survived, and she survived by clinging to the top of the piano, which was floating in the ocean. And I found out about this and I've written her story. So to me, that's my best book. Well, it would be because I've just written it. And the other answer to give you is that they're all my favourites, as I would be if I was a parent. You know, when you ask a parent who's your favourite child, most parents, certainly all the best parents, would say actually they're all my favourites in different ways.
Has there been an impacting event in your life that has inspired you to write about the war in the passionate way you do?
Only my childhood. But I will pick out one event from that. I think that's the best thing to do. I'll tell you of a childhood experience which still lingers in my head all these years later. When I was about maybe 5, we used to have a friend who'd come to the house. I would always look forward to it in a very strange way because he had been in what we call the Fleet Air Arm, which is, they used to fly planes down onto aircraft carriers. And he at some point had crashed. And he'd been terribly burnt. So his face was really scarred and discoloured. And he'd lost fingers on one hand and he had no ear on the right hand side. And I was fascinated for two reasons. First of all, to me, all these people were heroes. You know, these are the people who fought in the war and I looked up to them hugely, and I still do. But I was also fascinated by his wounds, and I couldn't take my eyes off them. And my mother always used to tell me, Michael, don't stare at Eric when he comes. You did last time, you did. So, you know, I'd sit there and I'd look at his watch, or I'd look at his tie or something, anything, not to look at his face. But in the end, sure enough, my eyes would go to his face and go to his hand because it fascinated me. And then, I suppose, years and years later, I realised that what I was looking at was what war does to human flesh, and that's as close as you can get, really, to how dreadful war is. So I suppose that, more than anything else, that man's face, haunts me still.
I consider you a legend. How does it feel to be a child's hero?
These words are very overused, if I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not a hero. I tell stories. I love telling stories. It's enough for me that children like the stories. I think it's not a good idea to hero worship people, unless it was a very small child, as I've just told you, with that extraordinary man who'd done what he'd done and lived through what he'd lived through. But someone who does what they do, you tell a story, and I hope the children love it, you're not a hero. Did I tell you who the heroes are? The heroes are the people that no one knows are heroes. So up and down this country and everywhere, what you will find is that there are people in their homes looking after people who can't look after themselves, quietly. No one knows about them at all. Now, if there is such a thing as a hero, it's those people because they live selflessly. I'm well rewarded for what I do. Choose another hero.
Can you give a message to people from my generation about why we should keep reading despite all our computer and gadgets?
I don't know any other way that young people can come to an understanding of themselves and relationships and other peoples and the world around them other than in books. I think it's the most extraordinary way of communicating. When I tell a book and I write it down, then you read the book, you open it up and you read that coded message which I've written. We call them words, we call them letters, you read it. And what your mind does then is to interact with that code, and it meets my mind because I made the code and your mind is interpreting it. So what you are doing all the time is making that story come alive in your own head. And because you're making that effort of the imagination, that leap of the imagination, what you are always doing is learning massively about probably things you don't know about. It may be the past. It may be the future. It may be geographically a different place. It may be people from another religion, another culture. All these things you can learn in books. And as you are growing up, the more knowledge you have, the more understanding you have, the more chance you have, it seems to me, of coping with a world that is, yes, potentially very joyful, but also very complex and very difficult. And I think books are a wonderful introduction to that, a wonderful preparation for it. It's too easy sometimes. With a book, it's never easy. You have to do the work, and that's really important.
Your books have had a huge impact on how many people, myself included, have initially learnt about World War One. But how do you think children should first be introduced and at what age to the war?
I don't think it's about age, because you can't judge a child by his or her age. It's when children are very, very young. and you're reading them and telling them stories, it is really important that they are not upset by stories. I don't mind them being sad, providing they arrive at hope and joy at the end. That's very, very important. However, there does come a time when these children are beginning to be aware of this war thing. It happens on their television in the corner and they get to hear about it. Then it's important they begin to read books which touch on the subject, so that they begin to comprehend what it is. I think it's important that even then you don't traumatize them, and even then you give hope. And even in the direst of stories, for instance in War Horse, which goes to a very painful place most of the book, at the end boy and horse find each other. In the end there is a reunion in no man's land between a German soldier and a British soldier. But you have not to patronize them. You haven't to talk to children as if they don't know anything and as if somehow you endlessly have to instruct them about it. Because actually these days they do know. They've picked up things all the time. And I think it's very important not to avoid subjects. Do you think it's not a good idea for them not to read Anne Frank's story? No, it's a good thing for them to read Anne Frank's story at the right time. And I've written myself about the Holocaust, and it's a very, very important thing to do because we have to know how wicked and evil people can be, but also how strong people can be to survive. I think that's important.
Do you think books are the biggest influence on how children learn? Is it really important also to have a happy ending in every war book?
Happy isn't the right word. I think when you've lived through a book like Private Peaceful, it's a book which ends terribly with an execution. The entire preparation for that execution has been building up right the way through the book. Is this a subject for children? I think probably I'd have to ask you that question. I just wrote it because I thought it was a story that needed to be written because of the 300 or so soldiers on our side who were executed that way. But even at the end of that story, the brother survives. And as he marches off, admittedly towards the Somme, in the summer of 1916, where we all know there is going to be this terrible battle, but in his head, there is real determination to survive.
And when you write about war, do you find it more important to be factually accurate or emotionally accurate?
Both. It's very important when you're dealing with serious subject like war to not to mess about with history. You don't have to keep to it. You don't have to tell the historical story. That's for historians to do. I mean, Shakespeare, you've heard of him, haven't you, was pretty good at taking history and manipulating it to his own advantage, because there are fantastic stories in history. And I think that's fine. But with recent history, you've got to be very, very careful. So, for instance, I've mentioned the Holocaust already. It would be very important that what you don't do is to twist what happened to such an extent that the truth of it is undermined. But if it's fiction, it's fiction. And if you invent, which I have done, two people who met in a concentration camp and played in an orchestra, it is important. There were orchestras in the concentration camps because the Nazis made them play as the people got off the trains to kind of calm everyone down. That is a truth. But the two people I've invented aren't a truth.
Some people also criticise pairing war, which you would link to brutality and death, to children. But why do you think that's right? Do you agree that we should be more patriotic, like Michael Gove says? Or
I think it's important when you discuss this whole matter of, you know, what we're going through now, this centenary, that we don't get into a war of words, because we are all entitled to our own take on this. Now, some people, I think, are implying that patriotism comes first, you know. For me, it's the pity that comes first, the pity of the 10 million lives lost. And you have to be very careful with patriotism. Do you know the story of Edith Cavell? Well, Edith Cavell was a very brave and extraordinary lady who was a nurse in Brussels in occupied territory during the First World War. And she would help people to escape, Allied soldiers to escape. Anyway, she was caught by the Germans and she was tried, condemned as a spy and executed. And she said, standing there before the firing squad, that patriotism is not enough. It is important, of course, that we value our country and what it stands for when we're proud of it. And when we're not proud of it, we should say so. It's deciding what is right and what is wrong and what is fair and what is not fair. All these things are just as important. We are 100 years away now from the First World War. We live in a family of nations. We can argue about Europe till the cows come home. But we live in a family of nations now. I can get in a boat, I can walk into Germany, I can walk into Switzerland, I can walk into France, I can walk into Belgium. There are no borders anywhere. We live in this extraordinary place that we've created. There's also things wrong with it, but let us think about how it was. We do live in an extraordinary, hopeful world now. I must be a bit Anglo-Saxon. Well, that's a bit German. I'm a bit Norman. I'm a bit French. Do you understand what I'm saying here? We're all this mix of peoples anyway. So our patriotism has got to recognise the history of where we've come from and then to recognise other people's love for their country as well. But I don't also want to be told by government how it is that I should think about the First World War. It's not the role of government to tell us that. I feel that quite strongly.
Warhorse recently started playing in Berlin. Do you think that was a big development? How did that make you feel?
Proud. I was more proud of that than I've ever been of anything with this whole Warhorse bonanza, I suppose, because it's been an extraordinary journey to have a book which no one wanted to read, which is suddenly this extraordinary play 25 years ago and a movie and all the rest of it, has been a bit of a roller coaster. But I suppose the thing which has given me more satisfaction is to sit there in that theatre in Berlin, the same theatre where the Kaiser sat, the same theatre where Hitler sat, and be on that stage and talk to German actors who are about to perform this play, which is about reconciliation and a longing for peace, which is really what the story is all about, was wonderful. And it's been on there now 6-7 months, and German people are seeing it in German. And to have these actors, German actors, singing English folk songs in German on this stage is wonderful. And it's gone all around America. And wherever it goes, what's really lovely is that people do recognise, I think, that the central figure of the story, Joey, represents, I think, a humanity. It's really bizarre to have a horse representing innocent humanity, because here you have a horse who was dragged into that conflict and who suffered, as the soldiers all suffered. I think people are responding to that, this longing that we all have. The world over, we have a longing for peace, and that's what that play is all about.
Stories such as Warhorse and Private Peaceful have moved many people and brought them to tears, but have you ever cried or felt moved when writing or rereading or seeing a film or play of your books?
Frequently. It's very interesting when you see the play, because it's not the same every night and it's not as good every night. But when it's just is perfectly right, yes, it leaves me in shreds, as it does an awful lot of people who see it. When I'm writing it, when I'm writing stories that touch on these subjects, I am also very moved. So the book I was talking about to Fernando, Listen to the Moon, which is really the story of a young girl's survival after the great trauma in her life and how she finds herself again. I did find that very difficult to write. And the more difficult a book is to write emotionally, for me, the better it is, because that means I'm lost in it completely. And with Private Peaceful, I've found it almost too difficult to finish it. I knew how I was going to have to finish it. And writing that last scene was, well, put it this way, I didn't go talking to people much afterwards.
And finally, your new anthology is being described as timeless, but do you think in 50 or 100 years people will still be writing about or talking about World War One?
Oh, yes. It is, in a way, in a strange sort of way, the most iconic of all wars. There's many reasons for that. First of all, it was the manner in which it was fought. It was the first time, really, that massed armies, not professional armies, massed armies of the people, from these streets all around here in King's Cross. There were people who went to the recruiting office and put on these uniforms. These weren't soldiers. They were lads, you know? And they came from farms and they came from offices. And they got together with chums. You had whole football clubs that, yeah, let's go and join up. And they joined up. They weren't soldiers at all. But they put on uniforms and they were put in this extraordinary situation. And then what they didn't realise, and actually the generals didn't realise, no one realised at all, is that we had invented weapons of war which were so overwhelmingly powerful and destructive that having lots of soldiers just made no difference. They were just wiped out whether it was machine guns or it was wire or there was the shelling. It was just overwhelming. So it was human flesh and horse flesh, if you like, against this extraordinary array of new armaments, which had been used massively for the first time. So the destruction was terrible, the suffering was terrible, the injuries were ghastly, and the grieving all over the world when people were touched by this war, and many, 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 many countries were touched by it, because it was truly a world war. This has lingered on. In a way, it's even more iconic than the Second World War, which did in fact kill more people worldwide. But there's something about the intensity of that conflict and the scale of the losses. So, for instance, on one day, the 1st of July, 1916, which is the worst day there's ever been for our country in terms of our people, 60,000 casualties in one day, nearly 30,000 of which were dead, in one day. And we know how terrible it is when one coffin comes back now from Afghanistan, and before that from Iraq, and how terrible we know that must be for the people. 25, 30,000 people received letters, families received letters after that battle. And when you go there, which I don't know if you've been, have you been to Belgium or France? Well, one day you will, I hope you will. I think every child, no, every person, but certainly every child, should go and look. And you go to a place called Ypres, which is the centre of a great battle in Belgium between the Germans and ourselves. And you walk along the canal there. There's a great gate there called the Menin Gate, on which the names of all the people who weren't found. So we know they died, but we don't know where their bodies are. They're all on this gate, tens of thousands of them. Huge, great gate. And then you walk along the canal, and you will come to a very beautiful, peaceful cemetery overlooking the canal. And you walk along the rows of these stones, really, with their names on. And I discovered many years ago about 20 New Zealand soldiers. So there's a little fern, that's their symbol. And every single name was a Maori name. I don't know if you know about Maori names, but they're long. So they cover the whole top. It's not John Smith. Huge, great long name. And then you look at the date. And they all died on exactly the same day. So you know this was a shell burst or something like just wiped the lot out. So I think it was that, it was the intensity of the war, and then I think it was what happened afterwards. There was the understanding of the war which came through the reading of the poetry and the making of the plays and the musicals, Oh, What a Lovely War and All Quiet on the Western Front, all these stories which in a way soaked this war into us and became how we have interpreted this war. I mean, that's how we find out about these wars. It is through stories, really. So I think those stories are going to last. I mean, they're great books anyway. And we have to go on writing those great books. That's very, very important. Not out of a sense just of remembrance, but because it is an extraordinary moment in history when history turned itself upside down. And that's critical. Because if there had not been a First World War, you have to think about this now. If, for instance, the Christmas truce in 1914 had worked and all the soldiers had climbed out of their trenches and said, excuse me, that's enough, I'm not doing this anymore. There would very likely have been no Russian Revolution. So you would very likely have not had the communist rise and Lenin and Stalin and all that sort of stuff in Russia, which did this huge division of the world. It would not have turned Europe upside down. I mean, Europe fell apart after that war. It was simply redesigned by those people who'd won it. And then, of course, what happened at the end of the war, as you know very well, is that America came across. And for the last year or so of the war, the input of their men and their materials, and yes, their money as well, turned that war around. It was fresh blood, a new inventiveness, and the Germans were exhausted. And that was the end of the war. But of course, it wasn't the end of the war, because 20 years later, having lost that war, and having known they'd lost it, and been humiliated by that, by us, actually, they rose out of the ashes of it under the banner of this Hitler man, under fascism. And then we know what happened to the world then. So it was, the agony went on. And so the First World War turned history up on its head in the most extraordinary way. I always think that Christmas truce, if only it had just spread along. and the generals hadn't been able to do anything about it at all. And they'd gone on singing their carols, and they'd gone on shaking hands and throwing down their weapons. And it could have happened. Do you know, I think if there'd been Facebook, it might have happened. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
It could have spread like wildfire all along. And it's I just find that the if of history. So that's why I think the First World War is never going to be forgotten. It turned history upside down. And of course, it made us what we are now. I have to say, and it's not a nice thing to say, there were positive things that came out of it. I should talk to you about women before the First World War in this country. Women knew their place, excuse me. They stayed in the home, by and large, and they did what they were supposed to do, which was mostly what they were told to do. Then the men went away. And women found a voice. They found power because they were very much needed. They worked in factories. They worked on the farms. What was discovered, much to some people's, disappointment, I expect, is that actually they could do the job really rather well without men. And at the same time, of course, the suffragette movement was growing and growing and growing. So I'm not saying you need a war that kills 10 million people to change things, but we are who we are now, you know, in large part because of that war.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With World Cup fever taking over, we at The Guardian are pretty sure that you're thinking big too. So maybe now is the time to use Squarespace to create your own professional website for your small business, portfolio, or blog. It's easy. You could create your own site during halftime. Just go to squarespace.com to start your free trial. And to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.